Chapter 8. A Very Crucial Word. For if one shows this, a man will retire from his error of himself. But as long as you do not succeed in showing this, you need not wonder if he persists in his error, for he acts because he has an impression that he is right. Epictetus, Discourses, Book 2, Chapter 26. Not so long ago, I went down to the Gione, one of the many small theaters scattered throughout the quarters of old Rome. The show was a production of Medea, the classic tragedy by Euripides, first performed in Athens at the Dionysia Festival in 431 BCE. Back then, the premiere didn't go well, and Euripides placed last in that year's competition. But he certainly had the last laugh. Unlike his rival Euphorion's work, which won then but has since been largely forgotten, Medea has been the most frequently staged Greek tragedy throughout the last century. The night I went, the wonderful Italian actress Barbara Di Rossi was playing the title role. Playing Medea is a very difficult undertaking because the actress needs to somehow evoke a feeling of sympathy for a character who, after all, kills her own children in revenge against her husband Jason, he of the Argonauts, who has just left her for a local princess. By the end of the play, the chorus is so shocked, and certainly so was the original public in Athens, that it simply cannot make sense of what has just unfolded on stage. Many-fold are thy shapings, Providence. Many a hopeless matter gods arrange. What we expected never came to pass. What we did not expect, the gods brought to bear. So have things gone, this whole experience through. Di Rossi pulled it off very nicely, but of course a lot of the credit goes to Euripides' brilliant study in the strong, intertwined human emotions of love and hatred. You see, Medea had previously helped Jason steal the fabled golden fleece from her native land, in the process betraying her father and killing her brother. She did it for love, and also to escape her barbarian country and come to civilized Greece. Remember, the play was written by a Greek. One of the intriguing characteristics of the piece is that it can be, and has been, read either as a tale of misogyny and xenophobia, Medea is a woman and a barbarian, or as a proto-feminist story of a woman's struggle in a patriarchal society. The violent passions of Medea may seem to be very much at odds with the alleged detachment advocated by the Stoics. Nevertheless, Epictetus relies on the story to make some crucial points about human nature and the practice of philosophy. It will take us a little bit to get back to Medea, so hang on tight. As it happens, Epictetus encountered the same problem that I run up against with my own students. They really want to study philosophy, but their parents tell them that it isn't practical, it's a waste of time and the like. Epictetus said, "This is the defense that we must plead with parents who are angered at their children studying philosophy. Suppose I am in error, my father, and ignorant of what is fitting and proper for me. If, then, this cannot be taught or learnt, why do you reproach me? If it can be taught, teach me, and if you cannot, let me learn from those who say that they know. For what think you, that I fall into evil and fail to do well because I wish to?" I pointed out to him that such talk is well and good, but it doesn't really get to the heart of the matter, which is not just to claim that learning philosophy will make you a better person, but to convincingly show that it does. So Epictetus continued, "What is the reason that we assent to a thing? Because it seems to us that it is so. It is impossible that we shall assent to that which seems not to be. Why? Because this is the nature of the mind, to agree to what is true and disagree with what is false, and withhold judgment on what is doubtful." "Maybe," I replied, "but an actual example would be more convincing to me, and especially to my students' parents. Feel now, if you can, that it is night. It is impossible. Put away the feeling that it is day. It is impossible. When a man assents, then, to what is false, know that he had no wish to assent to the false, for no soul is robbed of the truth with its own consent, as Plato says, but the false seemed to him true." Well, that's intriguing, isn't it? The point that nobody errs on purpose. Whatever we do, we think it is the right thing to do according to whatever criterion we have developed or adopted to establish right action. Much more recently, the philosopher Hannah Arendt made a similar point with her controversial idea of the banality of evil. Arendt was sent by the New Yorker to cover the trial of Adolf Eichmann, an SS Obersturmbannführer, lieutenant colonel, who had been one of the high-ranking Nazi officers in charge of the logistics of Hitler's so-called final solution for the Jewish people. Arendt wrote a series of highly controversial articles for the magazine about the trial, and these were eventually collected and published in her landmark book, Eichmann in Jerusalem, A Report on the Banality of Evil. Part of the controversy hinged on the idea that Arendt developed that evil is often the result of lack of thought, meaning that people usually don't want to do evil and certainly don't think of themselves as evildoers. But they also tend to follow the general opinion without critical analysis, and indeed, as in Eichmann's case, they are often convinced that they are doing a good job. The Obersturmbannführer was proud of the efficiency with which he worked, never mind that the work resulted in the deaths of hundreds of thousands of innocents in Hungary, where his activities took place. I found a tape of the last interview given by Arendt, who further clarified her thinking about the banality of evil. During the war, Ernst Junger came across some peasants, and a farmer had taken in Russian prisoners of war straight from the camps, and naturally, they were completely starving. You know how Russian prisoners of war were treated here. And the farmer says to Junger, "Well, they're subhuman, just like cattle. Look how they devour food like cattle." Junger comments on this story. "It's sometimes as if the German people were being possessed by the devil." And he didn't mean anything demonic by that. You see, there's something outrageously stupid, dumm equals ignorant, unwise, about this story. I mean, the story is stupid, so to speak. The man doesn't see that this is just what starving people do, right? And anyone would behave like that. But there's something really outrageous, empören equals shocking, revolting, about this stupidity. Eichmann was perfectly intelligent, but in this respect, he had this sort of stupidity, dummheit, irrationality, senselessness. It was this stupidity that was so outrageous. And that was what I actually meant by banality. There's nothing deep about it, the ignorance, nothing demonic. There's simply the reluctance ever to imagine what the other person is experiencing, correct? What both Arendt and Epictetus are getting at is a crucial Stoic concept, one that originally derives from Socrates. People don't do evil on purpose. They do it out of ignorance. Whenever I say this, someone is guaranteed to get outraged. What? Do I seriously mean to say that Hitler wasn't evil? How could I possibly be so naive? Or perhaps I harbor questionable sympathies. But as with many terms in philosophy, evil and ignorance don't mean quite what we expect. The term evil simply seems to invoke an unnecessary metaphysical category. If what we are doing is simply labeling a particularly nasty type of bad behavior, then there is little problem. But not infrequently, when we talk of evil, we slide into a fallacy known as reification, literally making a thing, which means speaking of a concept as if it has some kind of mind-independent existence, as if it is in some sense out there. Take the phrase evil personified, as in Hitler was evil personified, meaning the embodiment, the physical incarnation of evil. But evil isn't a thing characterized by independent existence. It has no metaphysical consistency. It is simply a shorthand for the really, really bad stuff that people do, or for the really, really bad character that leads people to do said stuff. So, in an important philosophical sense, evil doesn't exist. But the really, really bad stuff does. Now, let us tackle the more difficult concept, the idea that people do evil, in this non-metaphysical sense, out of ignorance. In the Euthydemus dialogue, Plato has Socrates say, "Wisdom alone is the good for man, ignorance the only evil," a phrase that has been misunderstood ever since. The word used by Plato is amatia, which, to be precise, does not mean ignorance, as it turns out. The philosopher Sherwood Belongia has written extensively on this topic, and it is well worth considering his explanation of it. Belongia begins with a conversation, from Plato's dialogue Alcibiades Major, between Socrates and his friend Alcibiades, an Athenian general and politician with, shall we say, a more than checkered record from an ethical point of view. Socrates, but if you are bewildered, is it not clear from what has gone before that you are not only ignorant of the greatest things, but while not knowing them, you think that you do? Alcibiades, I am afraid so. Socrates, alack then, Alcibiades, for the plight you are in. I shrink indeed from giving it a name, but still, as we are alone, let me speak out. You are wedded to stupidity, my fine friend, of the vilest kind. You are impeached of this by your own words, out of your own mouth. And this, it seems, is why you dash into politics before you have been educated. And you are not alone in this plight, but you share it with most of those who manage our city's affairs, except just a few, and perhaps your guardian, Pericles. The two Greek words for ignorance and stupidity are, respectively, agnoia and amatia. Among Athenians, Alcibiades was one of the most educated in the normal sense of the word, and he was obviously intelligent, again, in the normal sense. So neither of the English words ignorance nor stupidity really describe what Socrates is getting at. Instead, Alcibiades is unwise. He dashes into politics without the proper education, meaning without the sort of wisdom that comes from being virtuous. The contrast that Socrates makes between his friend and Pericles is particularly illuminating. Pericles was an Athenian orator famous for being not just educated and smart, but also wise. That is what made him a good politician, and that is what, tragically as it turns out, was missing in Alcibiades. Amatia, then, can best be thought of as a lack of wisdom, the opposite of sophia, the word that gives root to philosophy. Belongia helpfully adds, agnoia means literally not knowing. Amathia means literally not learning. In addition to the type of amatia that is an inability to learn, there is another form that is an unwillingness to learn. Robert Musil, in an essay called On Stupidity, distinguished between two forms of stupidity, one he called an honorable kind, due to a lack of natural ability, and another, much more sinister kind, that he called intelligent stupidity. Belongia also quotes philosopher Glenn Hughes, who provided a further elucidation of the concept of amatia and connected it to Nazi Germany. To Hughes, intelligent stupidity was not so much lack of intelligence as failure of intelligence for the reason that it presumes to accomplishments to which it has no right. Intelligent stupidity is no mental illness, yet it is most lethal, a dangerous disease of the mind that endangers life itself. The danger lies not in an inability to understand, but in a refusal to understand. And any healing or reversal of it will not occur through rational argumentation, through a greater accumulation of data and knowledge, or through experiencing new and different feelings. Instead, intelligent stupidity is a spiritual sickness and in need of a spiritual cure. So amatia seems to be a crucial word missing from the English vocabulary. It is the opposite of wisdom, a kind of dis-knowledge of how to deal with other human beings, and it results in awful actions undertaken by otherwise perfectly functional, intelligent human beings. Moreover, people characterized by amatia cannot simply be persuaded by reasoned argument, because they understand the argument, but are crucially deficient in their character, which, as the Stoics have shown us, is developed over time by a combination of instincts, environmental influences, especially family guidance, and reason. If something goes wrong early on in a person's development, it is difficult for reason alone to rectify the resulting amatia later in life. Which finally brings us back to Medea. Epictetus reminded me of what Euripides has Medea say. I know full well what ills I mean to do, but passion overpowers what counsel bids me. Epictetus added, Here, the very gratification of passion and the vengeance she takes on her husband she believes to be more to her profit than saving her children. Yes, I replied, but she is obviously deceived. Why then are you indignant with her, because, unhappy woman, she is deluded on the greatest matters and is transformed from a human being into a serpent? Why do you not rather pity her? If so, it may be. As we pity the blind and the lame, so should we pity those who are blinded and lamed in their most sovereign faculties. The man who remembers this, I say, will be angry with no one, indignant with no one, revile none, blame none, hate none, offend none. This is a stunning and profound insight into the human condition. It also shows a degree of compassion that popular lore associates far more with, say, Christianity than with Stoicism. And yet this is Epictetus, the slave-turned-teacher, who is speaking. Medea knew it was wrong to make her children suffer to punish Jason, but emotion, vengeance, not reason, drove her to act as she did. Epictetus advises pity, not indignation or anger, as our proper attitude toward Medea, because she is not evil, whatever that may mean, but a person lacking something important, like a lame person. The same word Epictetus uses to describe his own condition. Specifically, Medea lacks wisdom and is affected by amatia, the sort of dis-knowledge that brings ordinary people to make unreasonable judgments about certain situations that then lead them to what outsiders correctly perceive as horrible acts. If we internalize this Stoic attitude, or its equivalent in Buddhism or Christianity, we indeed will be angry or indignant with no one. There will be no one we revile, blame, hate, or are offended by. I submit that the resulting world would be significantly better than the one we currently live in. Epictetus elaborated on why he thought people like Medea are such tragic figures. Every error implies conflict, for since he who errs does not wish to go wrong but to go right, plainly he is not doing what he wishes. For what does the thief wish to do? What is to his interest? If then thieving is against his interest, he is not doing what he wishes. But every rational soul by nature dislikes conflict, and so, as long as a man does not understand that he is in conflict, there is nothing to prevent him from doing conflicting acts. But whenever he understands, strong necessity makes him abandon the conflict and avoid it. That is, Medea did not wish to err, but was simply convinced that she was doing the right thing. The same, I'm sure Epictetus would argue, was true for Eichmann, despite the vast differences between him and Medea in circumstances, apparent reasons for acting, and ultimate outcomes. Modern psychologists have discovered a pertinent phenomenon known as cognitive dissonance, a condition first described by the psychologist Leon Festinger. Cognitive dissonance is a very uncomfortable psychological state that occurs when someone becomes aware of the conflict between two judgments that he holds to be equally true. People do not want to experience cognitive dissonance, just as Epictetus said that people do not want to knowingly be in error. Thus, they reduce dissonance by endorsing any explanation that deploys what they think are good reasons leading to sound judgments, even though to others, those reasons and judgments appear to be obvious and even absurd rationalizations. Aesop described this delightfully in his famous fable about the fox and the grapes back in the 6th century BCE. The uncomfortable truth is, again, that people suffering from cognitive dissonance are neither stupid nor ignorant. I have encountered plenty of smart and well-educated individuals who nonetheless reject Darwin's theory of evolution, one of the most firmly established scientific theories ever. They have to reject it, because it seems to them to be an irreconcilable conflict with the Bible, the reference point for their whole lives as devout Christians. If we arrive at the judgment that either Darwin is right or the Word of God is true, then it is perfectly natural, rational even, for some of us to choose God over Darwin. Epictetus would not have been surprised, and neither should I have been when I met fundamentalist creationists face to face for the first time. But I was much younger and somewhat less wise then. As the writer Michael Shermer has observed, the more clever people are, the better they are at rationalizing away the sources of their cognitive dissonance. Conspiracy theorists, for instance, are often brilliant at explaining what others perceive as gaping holes in their theories of how the world really works. What's to be done, then? Once more, psychological research may be helpful here. We know that the best way to help students change their conceptual outlook about scientific notions is to purposefully increase their cognitive dissonance until they feel so uncomfortable that they themselves seek out more information and new sources to resolve the conflict. This, of course, is not always possible. I doubt that it would have worked with Medea or Eichmann, but the notion provides us with a good understanding of both what is going on and what, if anything, can be done about it. Still, I worry about the same sort of thing that critics of Hannah Arendt worried about. Isn't the idea of evil being banal, of amatia, dangerously close to an excuse for horrific behavior? Doesn't it, at the very least, encourage us to respond passively to evil? Naturally, Epictetus has pondered this as well. Such a one reviled you. Many thanks to him for not striking. But he did strike too. Many thanks to him for not wounding. But he did wound. Many thanks to him for not killing. For when, or in whose school, did he learn that man is a gentle and sociable creature, and that wrongdoing in itself does great harm to the wrongdoer? If, then, he has not learnt this or been convinced of it, why should he not follow what appears to be his interest? If this doesn't sound to you like turn the other cheek, I don't know what does. But Epictetus didn't stop at counseling endurance and patience, although he certainly did that too. He actually diagnosed what is going amiss. The wrongdoer does not understand that he is doing harm to himself first and foremost, because he suffers from amatia, lack of knowledge of what is truly good for himself. And what is good for him is the same thing that is good for all human beings, according to the Stoics. Applying reason to improve social living. As far as the rest of us are concerned, remembering that people do bad things out of lack of wisdom is not only a reminder to be compassionate toward others, it also constantly tells us just how important it is to develop wisdom.